From KMXT in Kodiak, it's the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Terry Haynes.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs. For more information, call 1-907-235-4966 or online at alaskaboat.com. Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
Kodiak was the first stop on the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's schedule to host meetings around the state about bycatch. KMXT's Brian Benoit reports that what started out as a question and answer session for department officials became a semi-moderated debate between fishers.
It was standing room only, and tension was high as fishers were eager to share their questions, stories, and even demands for controlling bycatch, which is the incidental harvest of a non-target species. Fish and Game Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang says the goal is to hear fishers' ideas about what regulations could help curb bycatch.
People are passionate about bycatch. They want tools to address bycatch. They want to know what the bycatch levels are. They want data to inform their decisions and recommendations moving forward. And there's a lot of passion about finding solutions.
Some attendees wanted to know what Fish and Game has in the works, while others brought anecdotes about massive hauls of incidental harvest. And lots of the attention was focused on bycatch and trawl fisheries. Vincent Lang says they're an easy target to blame, despite bycatch being an issue for all gear types.
And trawling probably catches more of a range of species in their trawl nets than any other fishery, so they become the target. But the longline fishery has equal amounts of bycatch.
The night ended with no real conclusion, though, as fishers stopped asking the commissioner questions and instead challenged each other for data and research. Vincent Lang attempted to moderate and give everyone who wanted to talk a chance to speak to the whole room. As the meeting ended, the general consensus was that everyone wants to see more data from Fish and Game.
I suspected at the end of the day there would be some debate going on amongst the different community members, but I think it came together at the end with people recognizing that all fisheries have some level of bycatch, and we all have to work together if we want to have a future in fisheries moving forward.
Fish and Game staff plan to hold similar meetings and hear from more fishers from around the state in the next 6 months. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Benoit.
And now, here's an audio postcard from the Kodiak Bycatch Town Hall.
I'm a tanner trout fisherman, community-based. I've been fishing crab my entire life. And all I want is to have these crab protected. Mark can tell you where they are. He can tell you the life cycle. He can tell you the volume that's there. And we have to be able to quantify the interaction of the gear groups that are participating on top of them. You know, I hear 40% the time the pelagic trawl's on the bottom. I hear 80% the pelagic trawl's on the bottom. I know inside of 3 miles, there's no pelagic trawling. So I don't know why the state of Alaska is continuing to allow pelagic trawling inside of 3 miles if we don't know if they're on the bottom or not.
As a fisherman who has fished here since 1990, I just bought a new midwater net, $85,000. And the last thing, the only thing I told my skipper when he left, we're in the business of catching fish, not wrecking gear. So do not compromise the net. Do not touch the bottom. In Kodiak, unlike the Bering Sea, we have volcanic bottom. It's abrasive. Everybody knows this. The sandbox is called the sandbox because there's some sand there. But look at the amount of wrecks down there. Look at the amount of crab pots down there. Look at all the derelict pots. You're not going to put your midwater trawl on the bottom. That's the reality. So when I hear 40% on the bottom around Kodiak, it is untrue.
I'm wondering if you can help me figure out why the Bristol Bay, Bering Sea, Red King Crab model defines trawl bycatch of Red King Crab as natural mortality. And when they do fishing mortality, it's only the retained catch of legal male crab. According to these guys, there's no bycatch. Or if there is, it's natural mortality. What's the deal there?
Well, here you say the mortality is accounted for. You just don't like it accounted for as natural mortality.
It isn't.
No, it's not.
Well, somebody had better do something about it before there's a legal aspect to this that people are going to be in trouble for it. Because it borders on fraud, sir.
When you look at the sheer numbers of the halibut bycatch over not only the Gulf of Alaska, but also the Bering Sea, and we're talking millions of pounds, the entire charter quota is only two. And so we got restrictions all the way down from the salmon. No subsistence, there's no sport, there's no gill net, there's no set, there's no drift. And every user group except for one is restricted to zero, nothing.
I've been involved in hot fishing, and I've been involved in several different fisheries. Long line, I had a jig operation. There is bycatch in every fishery. There's environmental consequences to every species based on the environment. I mean, you can haul crab up in the wintertime at 15 degrees and have major dead loss. And if you're caught fishing, you can... long lines leave gear in the water and then sand fleas eat the fish off of those accounted for. Trawlers have their bycatch. We're in the same boat. We're fishermen. We have a living... We're raising our families here. We're part of the community. We are all in this together. Let's work together to solve these issues, to solve these problems.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund, supporting conservation and harvesting of Alaska's wild, sustainable fisheries. Statewide support of the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from Satellite Technical Services, providing satellite communication solutions for commercial fishermen across the state of Alaska. Information and dealers can be found at satellitewest.com or by calling 206-321-6896.
The collapse of the King and Chum salmon runs on the Yukon River has been devastating for communities who depend upon them. The cause is still a puzzle, but scientists say that climate change is playing a big role. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George has been exploring the Yukon salmon collapse. Today, she digs into what we know.
When it comes to what's causing the Yukon salmon collapse, scientists know one thing for sure. It's not just one culprit. J.D. Ferguson is a fish pathologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He says researchers have identified a bunch of threats facing Yukon King and Chum salmon.
So it's really hard and probably unrealistic to just like point your finger at one thing and say, that's what's doing it.
Those threats pop up at every stage of the salmon life cycle. When salmon hatch in freshwater streams, as they swim down the Yukon to the ocean where they spend most of their lives, and on their arduous journey back upriver to spawn and die. Scientists think many of these threats are connected to climate change. There's lots of research happening right now, but there are three big problems they've identified. Problem number one, a parasite, which Ferguson is studying in his lab in Anchorage.
You know, this is where we do necropsies on fish. So
it's a room lined with refrigerators and lab equipment. Ferguson's colleague, Davis Stewart, slides a test tube containing a little chunk of fish under a microscope and shows me our salmon killer, Ichthyophonus.
This is a piece of heart tissue from a Yukon
Chinook.
And you can see all the Ichthyophonus growing out of it.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
under the microscope, the salmon tissue is mottled with big white dots, each one a single parasite that will grow, draining the fish's resources and causing cells to die. Many infected fish don't survive long enough to lay eggs.
And it's almost like an arms race. Like, can they get to the spawning ground before they die prematurely?
Ichthyophonus was first reported in the 1980s, but in recent years it's exploded. In 2021, scientists found it in more than 40% of Yukon King salmon sampled. It's unclear what's driving the spike, but Ferguson says warming river water might play a role. The Yukon is warming twice as fast as rivers further south as a result of climate change. And that brings us to problem number two, hot rivers, or, well, warm rivers. Dr. Vanessa von Biele is a U.S. Geological Survey ecologist.
I mean, it's crazy to be at the northern range extent of salmon and talking about it being too hot for them.
But it is. Salmon are cold-blooded, meaning they can't regulate their internal temperature. So when the river gets above 65 degrees Fahrenheit, von Biele says, that's a problem.
Their whole physiology, their whole body is designed to be in cold water. So when that water is warm, they just really hit these limits.
In a 2020 study, von Biele found that in an average year, half of all Yukon kings swimming upriver have heat stress. And it's not just the river that's warming. The ocean is heating up too, and that's problem number three. Climate change is bringing on more marine heat waves, periods of severe ocean warming. Jim Murphy is a NOAA fisheries biologist. He says marine heat waves are messing with salmon prey species. He says it's not totally clear what's happening at sea, but when he examines fish, one thing is clear. All salmon, but especially chum, are not getting enough to eat.
Their stomach contents, or the amount of food that they have in their stomach, has been declining with warming temperatures.
And scientists say all three of these factors, disease, heat waves, a lack of food, build on each other. A fish that didn't eat enough is already weaker as it starts its journey up the Yukon. Add a parasite and heat stress, and that fish is a lot less likely to make it to its spawning grounds to reproduce, meaning fewer fish next year. On top of all of this, people along the river have another frustration, commercial fishing. Many residents point to Bering Sea trawlers and a commercial salmon fishery along the Aleutians that they argue are intercepting salmon at sea that would otherwise be bound for the Yukon.
It kind of pisses me off a little bit thinking about it, because it's the double standard.
Basil Larson lives in Russian Mission on the Lower Yukon. He spoke to a weekly teleconference for river updates this summer. He says it's infuriating to see commercial fishermen pulling in hundreds of thousands of chum each season, while predominantly Alaska Native communities like Russian Mission have gone four summers barely able to fish.
We've been getting restricted and restricted and restricted, and it's not even funny anymore.
Meanwhile, commercial fishers point to data that show only a small percentage of the salmon they catch are headed to western Alaska rivers. But Jim Murphy with NOAA says commercial fishing is the one contributor we have control over.
Most people recognize that it is not what is causing the collapse of these runs necessarily, but it is something that can be regulated to mitigate the effects of declining production.
For now, Yukon River residents are in limbo, waiting to see if fish return. Murphy says it doesn't look like kings will come back anytime soon, but he says there's hope for chum. A recent Bering Sea heat wave hit chum particularly hard, but ocean temperatures have subsided, and Murphy says signs are good for a stronger chum run in 2024. In Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard accepted hands-on safety training for all of Alaska's fishermen and their families. AMSEA at amse.org or 907-747-3287.